So the first thing, you started out by saying that we have no non-perturbative description of stream theory. Then yesterday it seemed like we wrote down something that looked like a path integral for strings.
So that was a path integral. What I was giving yesterday was a formula to compute a single term in the perturbative expansion of string theory. So it was analogous to Feynman diagram in quantum field theory, an integral Feynman diagram. There is a way to write an action. There is something called string field theory that allows you to write down sort of an action from which you can derive this perturbative expansion. But it does not, I mean, nobody knows how to use that to do anything non-perturbative. It's more like a sort of an effective action. Okay. So today I would like to focus on the situation that is relevant to describing a single string propagating freely in space-time. So instead of having a complicated Riemann surface, I want to focus just on one tube, one cylinder, so a closed string propagating. So ultimately, the sort of information that we're going to derive from this picture will allow us to find out what is the spectrum of string states. What sort of excitations do you find in string theory? Which sort of infinite tower of particles, if you want, you find when you quantize a string. Now, in order to do calculations, I need to put some coordinate system on this cylinder. So let me just pick a set of flat coordinates. Let's pick a flat metric on the cylinder. I can use coordinates, say, sigma and tau. So sigma is going to be identified periodically, because I want the cylinder. And tau is just going to run from minus infinity to infinity. Now, I introduced here a length scale. Now, we know that the theory is well invariant. So the length scale shouldn't really matter. I keep it just because it will help me make a point at some point of the lecture. And then I will just set it to 1. I'm going to use a Euclidean metric. So this tau here is Euclidean time. Now you might already immediately complain, why am I doing that? After all, the most natural metric I could think of putting on the worksheet is the one inherited from space-time, right? Which should be Lorentzian, if my string is moving in space-time. But this question is completely analogous to in quantum field theory, do I use a Euclidean or a Lorentzian proper time when I do the calculations for the Feynman diagrams that I was showing you on the board? In the yesterday lecture, I used Euclidean proper time. I could have used Lorentzian proper time. I will discuss these matters more carefully next week. For now, let's just say that calculation in Lorentzian quantum field theory can anyway be derived from calculations in Euclidean quantum field theory by doing analytic continuation. So for now, let's just do calculations in Euclidean signature, which is simpler because we can use just standard complex geometry instead of whatever is the analog of complex geometry for Lorentzian space-time. But keep this question in mind. It's a good question. It's not silly. It's a meaningful question. It it becomes important when you ask things like, what's the analog of an I epsilon prescription in string theory? So we will discuss it in detail, just not now. The action that we were discussing yesterday, it described the motion of the string in space-time in a flat matrix, looked like this. Remember, here U1 is, say U1 is is tau and U2 is sigma. Now, this is really the sum of as many terms as dimensions you have in your space-time. So the field, the scalar fields are something like x0, x1, x2, all the way to xd. So we can just focus for now on a single scalar field, on a single coordinate, which behaves like a scalar field in two dimensions. So I'm just going to denote it as x. And then later on in the lecture, I will just 26 copies of them, or how many copies of them we need. Finally, it's also useful to remember the relation between Euclidean and Lorentzian time. And it's useful to also define a complex coordinate. Because as you recall, conformal transformations were most easily expressed in terms of complex coordinates. And this action becomes very simple written in terms of complex coordinates. So the action for a single scalar can be written once I get the sign right. Essentially becomes proportional to dx, d bar x. Okay, so.
Why are we calling it a scalar field with respect to what?
Well, I have an action for some maps from two dimensions into space-time, into the space-time of the string theory. From the point of view of the worksheet, each of these maps give you a collection of scalar fields. These are scalar fields on the worksheet. So as I was saying yesterday, doing calculations on a scattering amplitude in string theory of a single term in the perturbative expansion of a scattering amplitude requires you to do a two-dimensional quantum field theory calculation on the worksheet, where the fields are the positions in space-time, followed by an integral over the space of complex structures. So today we focus mostly on the two-dimensional quantum field theory calculation.
That's if you have more scattering fields.
Right, so then here the number of scalar fields equals the number of dimensions space time. I would just write them down a term of the act. Sorry, yeah, the action for one of these scalar fields. That's right. And then if you have many of them, you just add up. Mm-hmm.
So you're constructing the AB with this HAB.
That's right.
But the new indexes is the 26 dimensions, right?
I'm using a flat metric in space-time. That's a good point.
With big rotation or without big rotation?
Good point. With it's a Lorentz. I'm going to use a Lorentzian metric in space-time, but I will have to be extremely careful about what happens to the component x0 of my scalar field. So effectively, I will first treat this as it was a Euclidean coordinate in space-time, and then I will weak rotate. So I write down. So for now, see, because for x, the sign of the action for x0 is will be unusual. This is reflecting all sort of unpleasant things about the commutation relations and unitarity that we had to be careful with. This is somewhat analogous as when you quantize electromagnetism. You need to be careful with the A0 component of your connection, of your gauge field. But so for now, just let's focus on one scalar field. So you have seen canonical quantizations of free scalars. So I will not run through the extreme details of it. You take your scalar field, you expand it, say at some fixed time, you expand it into Fourier modes. Right? You perhaps look at the conjugate momentum, which is something like the tau derivative of x, and you expand it into Fourier modes as well. And then you impose canonical commutation relations. You write down your Hamiltonian, if you want, in terms of the or these degrees of freedom. You discover that your field decomposes into a tower of harmonic oscillators, except for the zero mode. So just skipping some of those intermediate steps, let me just write a final answer, and then we can check if it's the correct answer. So I'm going to decompose the field into modes. So these A's and A bars are the modes of these harmonic oscillators. The commutation relations look like this. So the A's and A bars are two independent sets of oscillators. Depending on n being positive or negative, these represent creation or annihilation modes for the harmonic oscillator. And on top of that, we have these two modes, X and P, which just satisfy the standard commutation relations of a particle. They describe the center of mass of your string. These are describe the central mass of the string. These describe the vibrational modes of the string. So the Hilbert. So if you want to check this expression, you could. You can, for example, compute the equal time commutator. Uh, you find okay, the expected answer. So this is the conjugate momentum to the position, to the field. Okay. Do you have any questions about this expression?
Mm-hmm. This is a real scalar field, right?
Yes.
So if we're using tau, then I can't see how it's real from this expression. It seems like the 2i on L peak tau term is probably. Or is it only meant to be real once we rotate?
Well, exactly. So whenever you say real, you really mean real in Lorentzian signature.
Okay.
So you can see this is really T.
But it's complex for now.
It's just a really bad idea to think of, to try to think in terms of real or complex Euclidean signature. You can still survive with bosonic fields whenever you try to think about fermions, and you try to ask yourself, is this fermion real or complex in Euclidean signature? You will get into infinite amount of confusion. So this is the weak rotation of a real scalar, if you want.
Thanks.
Okay, now, if I send it up, is it still visible? Not. Maybe I will not send it up for now.
I have a question. What's with the 4 pi I in the commutation relation for x and pi?
I could have put. I could divide it by 4 pi, the definition. It does convention. Okay, so I have my modes, and I can then now describe the Hilbert space or the theory compactified on the circle. So the Hilbert space is going to be a Fock space. For the oscillators. Meaning that some of these will annihilate a certain vacuum, and some of them will build on the vacuum to construct the tower of states. For the zero modes, I just had the same Hilbert space as for a free particle on the real line. So the Fock space will include a bunch of eigenvalues to the momentum, or the center of mass momentum, and then things built of them by turning on harmonic oscillators. Etc. So, is this statement clear?
Why are you only taking negative n?
Well, as I said, if you look at, say, A1 and A-1, the commutation relations A1, A-1 equal to 1. So, you recognize, if you compare this with harmonic oscillator, you recognize that this is a creation operator, and this is a destruction operator. So this state had the property that an on p vanishes if n is greater than 0. And also a bar n vanishes. So it's a standard Fock space, just that there are infinitely many I mean, oscillators. And I can write also a bunch of dual states. Now, the dual states are going to be any. So I have, of course, as usual, some delta function normalized. These are delta function normalizable states, as usual. And these dual states are going to be annihilated by an and a bar n, where n is negative. So whenever you want to compute some inner product in this Fock space, say I want to compute the inner product between P A1 and A minus 1 P prime, what you do is you simply commute them across so that you bring this to Q P prime using the commutation relations. And you get your inner product. Similarly, whenever you want to act on this state with some operator, if you have a destruction operator, you acting on a state, you have to commute it across all the modes until it kills the vacuum. Is everybody familiar with with Fock spaces? And how to do calculations with them? Okay. So there are a few observations which are in order. The first observation is that if you take an holomorphic derivative of x, you get a pretty nice expression. So the holomorphic derivative of x, it's an holomorphic function. This follows from the fact that the equations of motion are just del del bar x. So, which means del bar x is anti-holomorphic and del x is holomorphic. So what's going on is that x, if you see, is just a sum of an holomorphic and an anti-holomorphic function. Similarly, the S bar X is anti-holomorphic. Because of, sorry, 1 over L times P, sorry. So because of these expressions, it's actually convenient to define A0 to be P. And a zero bar to be minus p. This gives you more uniform formulae. So if you do that, then the a's are just the modes of this object, and a bars are the Fourier modes of this object. Now, a free scalar, free massless scalar, has a very simple symmetry. You can translate the scalar by a constant amount, and that doesn't change the action. Right. Now, can somebody tell me what the current for this symmetry is? The energy momentum tensor is a current for translations of on your space-time. Right. Here, unfortunately, there are two things we can mean for space-time. Here we're discussing the two-dimensional theory living on the worksheet. So there is a notion of stress tensor on the worksheet, which is the next thing we're going to discuss. But that has to do with shifting tau or sigma, not with shifting x. So how would you write? So in this two-dimensional theory, there is a current, two-dimensional current associated to this symmetry. How would it look like?
Relative of x on
yes.
The worksheet coordinates.
That's correct. So the ix is the current. So the current has two components, dx and d bar x. Now, normally, current conservation would tell you that the s bar derivative of this equals the s derivative of this, pretty much. S bar derivative of this plus s derivative of this equals to zero, which is true because of the equations of motion. But what happens here is that actually the individual components of the current are separately conserved. This is a special thing that tends to happen a lot in two-dimensional conformal field theory. It's associated to the fact that this theory actually has a much larger symmetry, which is just shift x by any holomorphic function or by any antihomomorphic function. You can easily convince yourself that this transformation does not change the action. So this is related to the fact that if you multiply, so the current for this, sorry, it was S and S bar. The current for this symmetry looks like this, F of S del S and G of S bar del bar X. So for all these currents to be conserved for every F and G, the fact that these are all conserved follows from the fact that this is holomorphic and this is anti-holomorphic. Now, this is not a terribly deep statement. I mean, in any free theory, you can always shift your fields by a solution of the equation of motion, just because the equation of motion are linear. So free theories always come with infinitely many symmetries. But what's nice in two-dimensional conformal field theory is that this sort of principle applies more generally to other things. Which we'll encounter momentarily. But it's just to say that you can think about these modes as conserved charges for some symmetries. See, to get a conserved charge, you integrate a current against on space, right? So if I look at a symmetry where x is shifted by e to the I and s over l, e to the ns over l, I would just look at the current e to the ns over l, d sx, and integrate it from sigma equal to 0 to 2 pi l, the sigma. Right? And if you do that, you get exactly, again, okay. So the last thing I will need about this scalar field is to compute some simple correlation function. So suppose I take some state here, some states, and I sandwich in between two of these currents. Actually, for simplicity, let me take the vacuum as one of these states. So You can just compute it by inserting this inside here and using results like that. So you will find something like this. So what happens is that essentially only the modes of only the ANs with negative n in here contribute, because the others kill this vacuum. And only the ANs with positive n contribute here, because the others kill the state at infinity, kill the state in the future. And so you get a sum of this sort, which you can just, it's a geometric series. And you get this following answer, the following answer. Now, this answer has a divergence when the location of this operator approaches the location of this operator. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, how did you define the state P?
Sorry, silly me. I forgot to write P equal to. They are again vectors for the momentum operator or the zero mode. Okay. So, and sorry, here there was supposed to be a delta function, delta P, because these are delta function normalizable states. Okay. If I had put a P prime here, I would have had an extra term in this sum involving a zero squared. So I would have just had an extra p squared added to the whole thing. Now, can you guess how does the divergence look like as s approaches s prime? Process. You did conform a field theory, right? I'm being very careful not to use the language of OPEs here, but maybe you might remember what was the OPE of the phi, the x. We would call it the phi. Well, you see here, there is something that goes like s minus s prime squared. The factors of L cancel out. So this is the divergence. Now, the reason I needed this calculation is that I want to define the stress tensor, the two-dimensional stress tensor. So, right. So the two-dimensional stress tensor is defined just as the variation of the action with respect to the metric. Right. Once I go into flat metric, and remember, this is conserved. Once I go to a flat metric and in complex coordinates, the classical stress tensor simplifies a lot. So if I lower the indices, I get the TSS is just minus 1/2 dsx squared. And TS bar S bar is just minus 1/2 ds bar x squared, while T of S bar vanishes. The reason this vanishes is that this is also the same as the trace of the stress tensor. You can convince yourself easily that in a while invariant theory, the trace of the stress tensor should vanish. Just because a Weyl transformation is just a variation of the metric proportional to the metric itself. Now, if in the quantum theory, an expression like that makes no sense, right? Because we cannot bring multiplied two operators at the same position. A good physical way to define it is use regularization like point splitting regularization, where you keep your operators slightly separated from each other, you subtract off the divergence, and then you send them together. So a good point splitting definition of the stress tensor would be something like that. ESS, which is usually just called T. I'm sorry for the confusion between T here and T that was the tension. Forget about that T for now. This is just the standard convention in conformal field theory. So I define it as minus 1/2 the limit as S prime approaches S of dSx of S, dS prime x of S prime, plus 1 over S minus S prime squared. Now here there is a very important point. There is some freedom in deciding what I subtract off. In principle. But there is one point that you should always keep in mind. Quantum field theory should be local. Locality is a very important property of quantum field theory. If you break locality, you lose a lot of good properties. So whatever you subtract off can only depend on what's going on in the neighborhood of S. For example, if you're trying to define a stress tensor on a space-time with a complicated metric, what you subtract here can be some function of the metric and its derivatives at that position. It cannot be a function, say, of the area of the manifold. It cannot depend on some properties of the manifold of space-time far away from your location. In particular, in this setup, it cannot depend on L. So you could have thought that perhaps I should just subtract off this whole thing in my definition. That would have been the normal ordering prescription, where you sort of subtract off the vacuum expression value of your product. But it's not okay, because this depends on the size of the cylinder. You cannot do that. So your definition of the stress tensor cannot be the normal ordering prescription unless you are in flat space, in R2. Because in R2, the expectation value of dx dx is going to be exactly this. So this is essentially the only reason I was carrying along L, to demonstrate the fact that what you subtract off cannot be this whole expression, but it has to be this. OK, now we can use this point splitting regularization to do some calculations. Now, actually, right. For example, suppose that I want to compute now the expectation value of the stress tensor between two states. So I need to take the limit as S prime goes to S of 1/2 of minus 1/2 of minus 1 over L squared e to the 1 over L S plus S prime over e to the S over L minus e to the S over L squared plus 1 over S minus S prime squared. And then there is the delta P that just goes along for the ride. So now computing, the interesting point is that this limit is non-trivial. It's not zero. So if you take the S to S prime limit of this expression, the divergent part cancels out, but the constant part does not. And the answer is minus 1 over 24 L squared delta of B. So in particular, the stress tensor tells, among other things, the amount of energy in a state. This is telling you that the vacuum on a cylinder has non-zero energy. This is called Casimir energy. It turns out that the Casimir energy is closely related to the Weyl anomaly. So the fact that there is a 1 over 24 here is actually the first sign of the Weyl anomaly of one scalar field is 1 as a coefficient proportional to 1. But I'll discuss this better later on. OK, so notice that we can use these expressions, right? Plug them into this definition and get a Fourier expansion for the stress tensor. Mm-hmm.
So can you still set R to 1 if you have the solenoid?
Yes, yes, it's fine.
Doesn't the anomaly mean that the symmetry is broken?
Right, so it turns out that, so the anomaly means that the symmetry is broken, but so if I were to write down the precise statement, so I can measure the breaking of the symmetry by the fact that the stress tensor is not traceless. Because you can prove easily that if the stress tensor is traceless, the theory is exactly, so the quantum stress tensor. So the classical stress tensor is a variation of the action with respect to the metric. The quantum stress tensor includes the variation of the measure too. In this case, so this is what this is about, really. So while invariance is a statement that the quantum stress tensor is traceless. Now, if you take this theory of a scalar field and you compute the quantum stress tensor on a manifold on a worksheet with generic metric, you'll find an expression like this. You'll say that the trace of the stress tensor is proportional to the Ricci curvature of this metric. So now it just so happened that if your worksheet is literally flat, you don't see this. So the lack of Weyl invariance becomes visible when your worksheet is not globally flat. So as long as it's work on the cylinder, we are not going to see the breaking of Weyl symmetry. At least not in an easy way. But you can see traces of it, which I will discuss in a moment. So what I wanted to do was to expand the stress tensor into Fourier modes. So if you use this definition, you get an expression like this. I will set L equal to 1 from now on. Okay, so if you do the calculation carefully, you get this the following Fourier expansion. There are these Fourier modes, which are sort of the most naive normal ordering way to combine Fourier modes of the shoe of DLX and DLX. And then there is this correction due to the fact that the definition is not normal order. Now, if you feel cavalier, you could have computed this minus 1 over 24 using something like zeta function regularization, meaning in your typical textbook, what they do is that they do the calculation naively without regularization. Then they find something like an expectation value of sum of a's, not like expectation value of sum of expectation value of an, a minus n, which gives them a sum of n, literally. Okay, and then they say this is minus 112. This works typically if you do things right. It's very easy to get the wrong answers doing it. But the correct way is to give a physical definition of the stress tensor and define the energy as the in terms of the stress tensor. So there's a correct way to understand Casimir energy. So the energy, in quantum mechanics, there is no zero for the energy, right? You could just shift the energy by a constant and nothing bad happens, right? So you could ask yourself, why is the Casimir energy a well-defined notion? The point is that in a relativistic theory, the energy is associated to must be associated to a local conserved stress tensor. That actually sets is a more constraining notion. So the correct way to compute the energy of the vacuum, right, is to first define a nice stress tensor with a local definition, which is conserved, and then use that to measure the energy. Which is what we did here. In terms of these modes, for T and for T bar, then the energy is just L0 plus L0 bar minus 1/12. And the momentum on the watch sheet, not to be confused with the momentum P conjugate to the center of mass position of the scalar field. So I use a capital P. I hope it's distinguishable from a little p. The momentum is L0 minus L0 bar. So what's the energy of this state? These are the definitions, they're on the board. Because this is normal ordered, only A0 squared matters. So L0 acting on P gives me just 1/2 p squared, right? L0 acting on A minus 1 p can be computed in the same way. You get something like 1/2 p squared plus 1. And so on and so forth. Sort of every, so A minus 1 raises L0 by 1, A minus 2 raises L0 by 2, A minus 1 bar raises L0 bar by 1, A minus 2 bar raises L0 bar by 2. So here, when I depicted my Fock space, I organized it in terms of the energy of the states. So this is energy p squared minus 1/12. This is energy p squared minus 1/12 plus 1. Same here. It has p squared minus 1/12 plus 2, and so on and so forth. On the other hand, this has zero, has no worksheet momentum, because both L0 and L0 bar are the same. This has 1 unit of worksheet momentum. This has minus 1 unit of worksheet momentum. And so on and so forth.
Could you just lower that board in front?
Hmm?
Could you lower the board that's in front there for a second? Lower it, if possible.
Ah, lower it more? Sorry.
Yeah. So, when you... So, what I don't understand is the in the definition of E, or
mm-hmm.
in the expression for E,
yes.
L0 plus L0 bar.
Ah, yes, what was the board? Mm-hmm. Yes.
So why does L0 bar not act on P?
What do you mean, act on P?
Like.
So,
so what's the total energy of the state P?
So it receives a contribution P square over 2 from this,
yeah.
Little p,
yeah.
Square, P square over 2 from here,
oh, okay.
Minus 112. Because remember, both A0 and A0 bar were equal to P.
Okay.
And L0 starts at 1 half A0 squared. Okay. So finally, we could try to compute the algebra of these Fourier modes. So how do I compute the commutator of two L's? If you try to use directly these expressions, you're going to get infinite sums again, infinite divergent sums again. And you'll have to try to use zeta function regularization or something like that. But the correct way to do it is to first ask yourself, how does L act on the fields? And then Fourier expand that. So you need to do sort of three calculations. First, you ask, how does Ln act on X? This is a neat calculation. You just use this expression and act on and commit it across this. Right. And you get a very intuitive answer. You get something like e to the ns ds x. So why does this make sense? Well, so T originally, so the stress tensor is always the generator of translations. Right? It's the conserved current associated to translations of the worksheet. But here, something magical happened, analogous to what happened to the conserved current for translations of X. Although the divergence of the stress tensor, strictly speaking, should just be that, the individual components of the stress tensor are separately conserved. This is holomorphic, this is anti-holomorphic. So you have a del bar TSS equal to zero, and del S TS bar S bar equal to zero. Right? So that means that I can multiply the stress tensor again by any function of S, and I still get a conserved current, which means I get conserved charges by just taking Fourier modes of T. So the LNs are, again, conserved charges for some symmetries. What are these symmetries? These symmetries are just conformal transformations.
I don't understand. Can you explain again why LN are symmetries?
Because LN, what is LN? LN is just the Fourier mode of the stress tensor, right? So it's a contour integral of sigma equal to 0 to 2 pi of e to the ns t of ss. But that's the conserved charge for this conserved current. So what are these symmetries doing? They are just coordinate transformations. S goes to s plus epsilon e to the ns. These are holomorphic coordinate transformations. Remember, holomorphic coordinate transformations leave the metric, combined with the wild transformation, leave the metric unchanged, leave the theory, leave the action unchanged. So this is definitely a symmetry. I map x of s to x of s plus epsilon e to the ns. This does not change the action. Does not change the action. This is the symmetry generated by a lens, and you can see it here, right? The infinitesimal change of x is precisely this vector field acting on x. So now, with a bit more patience, you can ask how does ln acts on dsx of s, dsx of s prime of s prime. Right? There is no difficulty doing this. These are operators are separate points. I'm just commuting L across this and across this. Right? So that's a very simple expression. And then you can apply your point splitting definition and derive how does L act on T. And you find something interesting. So if you just ignored these extra terms that come from doing the proper regularization, this would just be the standard way a tensor transforms under conformal transformations. So you do a coordinate transformation like that, a scalar field transforms like this, but the tensor gets an extra power of the Jacobian in front. So this is just what this 2n is. It's a correction due to the Jacobian squared. But we get these extra corrections. So the stress tensor does not quite behave like a tensor under conformal transformations.
How do you infer that from here? How do you infer that it is not a tensor from here?
Well, because this is by definition how a tensor transforms under a coordinate transformation. So if I have extra terms, it means that the stress tensor does not behave like a tensor.
So it's a coordinate, like a transformation, that S, a transformation of S?
Yes, I map S to S plus a small multiple of e to the ns.
Could you explain again how the...
So
I actually don't understand why that is how you expect a tensor to transform.
Well, how does a tensor, so if I do a change of coordinates, right? I just take my original tensor, write S as a function of S prime, but I also need, I need to deal with the indices, right? So I also need to multiply by the S over the S prime squared. Now take S prime to do this. So you do the infinitesimal version of that. And you get this expression. See, this is just a change of coordinate, and this is just the Jacobian. The fact that there is a 2 here is the fact that it's the square of the Jacobian. See, what is the Jacobian? It's just 1 plus epsilon n e to the ns, right? Squared t of s plus epsilon e to the ns. So expand this in a deleting order in epsilon, you get precisely this.
But why is that the, like, why should that be the commutator of ln?
Because ln implements these transformations. So the fact that there are corrections means that the stress tensor doesn't quite behave like a tensor. Now, this is definitely a manifestation of the fact that Weyl symmetry is broken, in the sense that, as I said, to see the Weyl anomaly, you need to put a non-trivial metric on your manifold, okay, instead of flat metric. Well, if you have a metric which is infinitesimally close to the flat metric, that's the same as just inserting your stress tensor in a correlation function. Insert your stress tensor, multiplied by the variation of the metric, and integrate. But the variation of the metric is a tensor. So this expression is invariant only if t is a tensor. Because the variation of the metric, if I change coordinates, right, just changes by the Jacobian. So these extra terms are telling you correlation functions, if my metric is not flat, will not be invariant under Weyl transformations. So in particular, for a general theory here, you'd find the sort of the central charge that I was discussing. So the fact that you have a one here is the way you see that this theory has central charge one. If you then take this expression and you Fourier expand it further, you find finally the commutator between the modes of the stress tensor. So this is called the Virasoro algebra. If you didn't have this term, this would just be the algebra of vector fields, you know, of diffeomorphisms of your surface, right? This is if I just take the Poisson bracket, right, between the vector fields e to the ns ds and e to the ms ds, you just get precisely this. So if I take the commutation of two coordinate transformations, I would naively get this. But the actual algebra is deformed as a consequence of the Weyl anomaly. It's centrally extended, more precisely. So this is called the Virasoro algebra.
So you say that you want to construct a local theory, but in some sense, the correlators already know that about the global topology.
Sure. The correlators can know about global topology. It's the definition of the operators that cannot know about the global topology.
Why the correlators can know about it?
What do you mean?
It's not clear for me why
you can definitely define operators which are not local.
Mm-hmm.
You're free to do so. But those operators have properties which are less nice than operators which are local. For example, if I have two operators that are non-local, the correlation function of these operators might diverge even if the operators are not at zero distance from each other.
For example, when you compute a correlation function,
mm-hmm,
using the path integral.
Yes.
So the operator that you're going to put in the path integral is local.
Yes.
When you sum over all.
That's right. The correlation functions obviously know about space-time. But it's the questions I want to ask. So what are operators? Operators are the questions I can ask my theory. That's the definition of operator. And it's useful to consider. The definition of local operator is questions which only depend on the neighborhood of space-time. And it's useful to think about local operators, they think. But in a sense, a lot of the axioms about quantum field theory are about how local operators behave and which properties do they have. Like, for example, the very basic property you want is that the questions I can ask at this point should be independent from the questions I can ask at this point. This is pretty much the definition of quantum field theory. Quantum field theory is a physical theory where I can ask completely independent questions at each point of space-time. So So the list of local questions is important. And has special properties as opposed to questions that involve a whole patch of space-time. For example, if you define a stress tensor in a local way, it is satisfied the nice property that in a correlation function, so this is supposed to satisfy word identities, right? Which are, so it's not exactly zero, but it fails to be zero only at the location of the other operators. If I defined my stress tensor in a non-local way, I will probably lose this. Okay, are there any more questions about this? So in determining the string spectrum, which we'll do a little bit by hand at the beginning of the next lecture, we mostly need the description of this Fock space and the definition of energy and momentum of a state. Because what we need to do is sort of take 20 D copies of these scalar fields, and then impose what we're called the constraint that came from gauge fixing. It's called the Virasoro constraint. The classical statement is that the stress tensor vanishes in a solution. Then you need to understand how to express the quantum mechanically, but sort of we'll do it a bit by hand in the next lecture, impose the Virasoro constraint, and see which states preserve the constraint. And then we'll find the spectrum of strings. Any more questions? Okay.